Welcome to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. I'm Lori Lee Binstock. When many people think of mental illness, they think it's an issue isolated in the brain, but science says that's simply not true, especially for people suffering from PTSD. In treatment, I tried different modalities, but one that helped me make significant progress in treating my PTSD was somatic experiencing. Joining me now to talk more about somatic experiencing is trauma therapist and somatic experience practitioner Dale D'Annunzio, who also was my somatic therapist. Dale, thank you so much for coming on a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast.
My pleasure.
Well, first off, could you explain what is the somatic experiencing method?
Somatic experiencing is a type of trauma release that was created in the 1990s by Dr. Peter Levine. And Dr. Levine studied animals in the wild and their nervous systems and psychology, and he put the two together. And basically, the word somatic means of the body, and that Dr. Levine calls trauma trapped energy in the nervous system. In other words, he's saying that if we look at the nervous system and understand it, then we can work with people to promote their own natural mechanisms to work through trauma. In the wild, animals don't have the luxury of trying to go to counselors or work through their trauma that way. They have an inherent mechanism. The natural system for all of our nervous systems, there's an underlying goal of survival. And our autonomic nervous system, the involuntary nervous system, its two basic responses to threat are fight or flight. Now, most people have heard of fight or flight. Mm-hmm. I'm either going to fight the threat or I'm going to run from it. And both have a simple elegance to keep us safe.
You know, one of the things when I was at CR Tucson that you explained, it was the whole, was it the gazelle or the antelope that was running from?
In the wild, Dr. Levine was looking at a lion, and lion goes to hunt, comes upon a herd of zebra, picks a zebra, and chases it. So if we're tracking what's happening in the nervous system of the zebra, that's going to help us understand how trauma is created. With the lion and the zebra is obviously going to be in flight because it recognizes it can't fight the lion and survive. So the zebra is in flight, and then the lion is faster. So it catches the zebra. And at that point, the zebra can no longer be in flight for survival because the lion has caught it. And the zebra can't be in fight because it will lose. So the zebra's nervous system automatically kicks into a last-ditch effort phase called freeze. So the last-ditch effort of freeze for the zebra is I'll hunker down and hope the danger passes. That's all the options it's got. It's been likened to if I plug too many appliances into an outlet, what happens to the circuit? The circuit breaker blows. And it's the same with the zebra. The circuit breaker blows and the zebra stops all functioning except the very, very basics to keep alive. So shallow breathing, shallow heart rate. But it shuts down all the other mechanisms of the nervous system. Dr. Levine says the zebra does not feel physical pain the same way that it normally would. You've heard of people being shot in the leg and not realizing it for like 20 minutes. Because they're in freeze. Their nervous system is doing its best to help us survive, just like with the zebra. In some cases, the lion may get distracted or taken away from the zebra, and the zebra has a chance to get up. And where does the zebra run? It runs back to the safety of the herd. Safety in numbers. Mm-hmm. Safety is one of the main concepts of somatic experiencing. So the zebra runs back to the safety of the herd, and there is where it shakes. Because energy that was bottled up because of freeze is now in the nervous system. And the only way to get the nervous system reset is for that shaking to occur. That's a natural mechanism for the zebra and all other birds and mammals.
But as humans are completely different.
Correct. Well, We have the same mechanism. We have a similar nervous system, fight, flight, and freeze. But we have an additional part of our brain. That's the neocortex human thinking brain that the zebra doesn't have. And unfortunately, that thinking brain interferes with the natural mechanism to release that pent-up energy and get the nervous system reset. And as you know, that pent-up energy accumulates from event to event. If we could just look at the zebra, when the zebra moves out of freeze and starts to feel again, because as it moves out of freeze and starts to shake and feel again, it has to encounter that fear, panic, and terror on its way to relief. People come out of freeze, they start to feel that fear, panic, and terror, and people don't like it. So what do? We go back into freeze to not feel, or we self-medicate. We have to learn to grow our capacity to feel our emotions and sensations, even if they're frightening, even if they're intense, because that will help the natural course of our nervous system to release the pent-up energy that was trapped when we went into freeze.
So then when parents are basically saying, you know, don't cry or don't feel your feelings, that's really the wrong thing to say.
Correct. Because the child is already feeling those things. To try to tell them not to feel it just confuses the child.
Well, I do want to move on to, you know, you've been practicing for more than 35 years, but it's only been in the last few years that you focused on treating trauma with different modalities. Why did you move to trauma?
In treating a number of people, I realized there was something else that needed to happen rather than just the usual talk therapy. And I'm not saying talk therapy is bad, but I wasn't satisfied that it was rich enough or effective enough to fully help people. It didn't have to go against all that I had learned. I found it extremely effective to have this added piece of looking at what the nervous system is doing. Because logically, people would come in and they're like, I don't want to feel this way. I shouldn't feel this way. And I'm like, but your nervous system is trying to do its best. And that's one of the things I loved about somatic experiencing, trying to understand that the symptoms are a result of the nervous system overlinking events or underlinking events.
I agree, because honestly, I've been through a lot of traditional therapy and nothing really helped until I actually went to see Air Tucson and I saw you. You know, I've done a lot of beneficial work with you, much if not all of the work produced immediate and effective results, or at least a better understanding of myself, including a genogram and revisioning. And I'm just curious, how do these therapies actually fit with somatic experiencing?
Well, they fit because I make them fit. Meaning this, I think one of the hallmarks of good therapy is definitely the fit between a therapist and their client. My original background is in family therapy, and understanding that if we can recognize the dynamics, the emotional currents of a family, it's not about blaming people or parents. It's about understanding what happened and then moving into a place of understanding to again release what isn't effective, thereby promoting one's natural resilience, as Dr. Levine said. And I think that good therapy often results in promoting that inherent wisdom that people have. And when I do therapy, is to try to get people to understand that they have their own inner wisdom if they can access it. Trauma interrupts that ability to access it.
You did talk a little bit about the genogram and the concept behind it. I found out a lot more. I dealt with the event trauma of sexual abuse as a child, but through the genogram see that I actually had more than just that event trauma. It was a complex trauma of my mother, my brother, and I thought that was interesting and it made me look at things in a really different way. And I know that I spoke to some clients over at CR Tucson, their parents were like, I feel like they're just blaming us for your problems. I mean, really, what would you say to those parents that are saying that?
That's a really good question. And I like to say that we're shaped by our families, and to ignore that totally is not healthy. And it's more when I do a genogram or even look at the parents' family and how they got to be the way they were, ultimately, I think it builds a more compassionate bridge. But back to your question, I want someone to understand the emotional currents that are going on, that went on for a number of years in the family of origin. We are wired for our survival to learn to feel like we belong with our families. For our own survival, we have to feel like we belong. Otherwise, we, you know, evolutionarily, we'd be like, we're left in the woods to die. Mm-hmm. So we're wired to make sure we are a unit and that we belong with that unit. So no matter how dysfunctional or loving, and usually a combination of both, because our parents are human, mm-hmm. we're going to do whatever we can to promote that feeling of belonging. And one way that we as children, right from the get-go, start to feel like we belong is we become like our parents, because that secures us to feel like, oh, we won't be left in the forest. We belong with these people. We take on their values. We're not only shown by example what they do, we internalize it so that we can feel like, yeah, we're going to be that way. If I'm born into a family in the Midwest farming, that's going to have a lot of different cultural values than if I were born into a East Coast mob family. I find that idea of growing up in a family really fits in with the idea that we all probably had developmental trauma because our parents were human and we couldn't get from them what we needed all the time.
When I was getting discharged from CR Tucson, I had a tough time finding a somatic experience therapist in Washington, D.C. So I actually had to go to Miami, and they still don't have a somatic experience therapist here, but they, you know, they do have an EMDR therapist who's helped me. But to be honest, it was really hard to find any treatment center on the East Coast focus on trauma. And it was mostly centers for substance abuse. And why do you think that's the case, that people aren't really focused on trauma?
I'm very lucky to work at CR Tucson because they took kind of a cutting edge approach many years ago and understood the value of treating trauma, because a lot of symptoms like addiction, depression, panic attacks, flashbacks are a result of trauma. So instead of trying to treat the symptom, they look at trying to treat the cause. And I just think they're ahead of the game, particularly compared to a lot of the East Coast treatment centers.
And another thing that I found helpful was revisioning. I found that to be so effective. And at my current treatment center, I asked them, you know, do you guys do revisioning? And, you know, obviously they said no. And I was like, why? It was so effective for me. And it was so effective for so many other people at CR Tucson. And I guess it was an evidence base. But what moved CR Tucson to begin revisioning?
Well, I think CR Tucson is forward-looking in a lot of ways. And I know that CR Tucson actively pursued bringing the originators, the creators of revisioning, to CR Tucson. You're right. Revisioning is really new, really cutting edge. And it works on the principle of there are mirror neurons in the brain. Just like we have a hemisphere for reading and writing and a hemisphere of the brain for spatial and art, there's another area of the brain where mirror neurons are. And revisioning came about because people who had lost a limb and had phantom limb pain, they did this technique of using a mirror. Like if if I lost my right hand, they would have me put my right arm into this, what they called a mirror box, and then have me put my left hand in that mirror so that my arm with the mirror looks like it has my right hand back. And what they found in the brain, the part that was missing, in other words, my hand, my right hand, had lost its neural connections. So once my eyes took in that part was back, it could reorganize the brain and put back in place, in its proper position, the right hand. And it only looked like a right hand because it was in the mirror for my left hand. So they had such super success with using the mirror box for phantom limb pain because the researchers were finding in one session the phantom limb pain was going away. So they knew they had something. And then scientists got involved and could really understand that it was the mirror neurons now had an image that was in the proper place. Even though I might not have my right hand, in my brain, it was repositioned. And people were like, I've had the pain for 10 years and now it's gone. And, you know, anecdotal stuff was amazing. And then they researched it and found the effectiveness of using the mirror box. So the people doing revisioning in Dallas, Mark Ryder and Lynn Heselton, decided to try it with people who had lost a loved one. And most people grieve, but there's exaggerated bereavement where there's like inconsolable. And so what they found was if they were working with a client and brought a picture of the person they had lost and like an article of clothing and set the picture and the article of clothing up next to the person and had them look in the mirror, the person could move through the whole grief response because their loved ones was now repositioned in their mirror neurons in the proper place for them to move through and adequately grieve that person's passing. So they had such luck with that, they decided to try it with other aspects of the personality. Like trauma, they would say that there's the before trauma person and the after trauma person who were disconnected. So the mirror was used to bring in the lost self, the younger self before trauma, and reposition it in the mirror neurons in the brain to kind of reinstate what that person had experienced before the trauma.
So, you know, we were talking about my best self, and
right.
the one thing that really affects me from being my best self was my worrying self or my anxious self. And I remember we worked on that. I drew a picture of what I thought my best self, what symbolized my best self. And I think it was a flower and then my worrying self. Then it was like a cloud and we connected it. And then you made me say some things. I don't know if those, how, you know,
yep.
how basically how my worrying self contributes to my best self in a way that it just warns my best self, but there are things that I can do to not let that worrying consume me, like fact right. check. And, you know, and literally the same day that I did the revisioning that night, I woke up at 3 a.m. and I had this nightmare that something happened to one of the residents who I was really good friends with. And I know she had a hard time and I was really worried about her. And I just laid in bed and I couldn't sleep. And I just said, you know what? I can just go to the nurse's station and ask them to check on her. And I got up at 3 a.m. in my pajamas and my slippers. And I walked to the nurse's station and I said, is this person okay? And they're like, oh yeah, we just checked on her. I was like, are you sure? And you know, they did. And she was fine. And I was able to go back to sleep instead of tossing and turning like I usually would until it was okay for me to get out of bed and go to her room and see if she was okay.
Right.
But when I was in bed, the first thing I thought of when I realized I can go to the nurse's station and be and figure it out on my own, I was like, it was the revisioning. And since then, I haven't let my worrying self affect or my anxious self really affect me. I mean, I notice the sensations in my body when I get that feeling, and then I'm like, okay, wait a minute. I don't need to be that worried about it. And then I can figure my way through it where it's not consuming me. So that has helped me significantly. And it just blows my mind that no other treatment, or I don't know what treatment centers do it, but I know that the one that I'm at does not.
I think Sierra Tucson's the only one at this point. And like you were saying, you know, there's a inherent difference, just like the phantom limb, the people who had the phantom limb, it literally changed it. I want to caution the idea that just one session is going to do it. The reason I believe a lot of the revisioning works as well is because there already was the therapeutic wherewithal and support and self-support to do it. So revisioning isn't for everyone, but revisioning is a great tool when I'm working with somebody and I feel like they're ready for it, that can bring in and have very strong, kind of remarkable results. So
I remember the first time I was going to see you, and I know you're like, oh, that was just a rumor. Everyone who tells me that they have a session with you, they're, especially if they're doing something like revisioning, they're just exhausted. And there was a point where after I saw you and we did the genogram, and then I was falling asleep in groups. I was like, I have to just sleep. And I literally went to bed for like a whole day, it felt like. And then, you know, then some of the other residents were like, yeah, did you see Dale? Yeah, because somatic experiencing is exhausting. I mean, why is that?
Emotional work is exhausting. And I think that when you make the initial leaps and insights, it's exhausting because from a somatic experiencing perspective, we have to integrate those changes. So if we make a big leap, we have to physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually take that change in. So resting, remember somatic experiencing, we follow the impulse of the body. Mm-hmm. If the body's tired, I mean, I have people who are like, I shouldn't be tired. I'm like, it doesn't matter the amount of sleep you get sometimes. If you're doing emotional work, it's tiring. And you have to allow yourself to listen to your body. That's the wisdom of the body. And you need sleep. So you were, in my estimation, you were ready to make these insights. And you were ready to put them together. And you not only knew them intellectually, you were doing the work emotionally and somatic.
There was someone at Sierra Tucson who actually, I think I told you this, they did, I was there for craniosacral, and she also does SER work. And so then we started going into, she's felt something in my neck, and she's like, did you ever get in a car accident? And I said, yes, like I was 16 years old. I mean, that was forever ago. She's like, yeah, that still can affect you. And then she started asking me details about it. And then it was interesting because then I started getting flashbacks. And from what, you know, what I've always remembered for the last 20 years is that, you know, I thought I, you know, hydroplaned and got in a car accident. But I what I remembered when I was on the table, when she was doing the SER, I started getting flashbacks, and I realized it rained that day, but it wasn't raining. And then I started remembering that I actually tried to overdose on some pills. And the more I talked about it with her, out of nowhere, it was really crazy, because that morning I put in an order for a heating pack for my neck because I just couldn't move it. And then when I got off the table, the range of motion that I had was significant. It's like the pain went away after having to deal with it for weeks and on and off again for years. So I thought that was very interesting. And I guess, would you say that was the trauma that was trapped in my neck? Oh,
absolutely. I think it sums up the idea that healing has to happen on an intellectual, an emotional, and a somatic level all together. And so working from what you're telling me she was on the physical and then she spoke with you and she loosened up the trapped physical energy enough to allow the memory to come back and be processed and then released.
That was pretty mind-blowing to me. When we were going through the work and we were getting into, like, I was getting into the timeline and everything, and I just remember starting to get rashes on my wrists, and then I started getting flashbacks of cutting my wrists, and I just, it really opened my eyes to how the mind and the body really work together. And like you were saying, just how the nervous system is, you know, it, how it works with the mind, and it just, it's insane to me. Yeah, it was a lot of work, and I'm so grateful and thankful for it. And I'm grateful to you for all the work I did, and all the benefits from the work I did with you. Is there anything else that you would like people to take away from our discussion?
I would like for people to approach healing as holistically and recognize that it's a process, just like, you know, nutrition. I could tell a class of people what they should and shouldn't eat, but them getting the sense of what's healthy for them, it doesn't guarantee that they're not going to ever get sick. It just means they're more prepared.
Appreciate you coming on at Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. And that was trauma therapist and somatic experiencing practitioner, Dr. Dale DiNunzio. If you would like to learn more about Dale and the different modalities that we discussed, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.